You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Congress has traditionally held the power of the purse. Lately, though, they are starting to loosen their attachment to those purse strings. Today, our Dakota political junkies will talk about a shifting model for presidential authority. David Wiltsey is a professor of political science at South Dakota State University. Lisa Hager is an associate professor at SDSU. And they joined us from SDPB's Janine Basinger studio on the campus in Brookings. What is the power of the purse? What does that mean?
Well, that comes from the constitutional authority of Congress to appropriate money. And this is something that Congress typically has very jealously guarded over the years. And it's something that, for the most part, Congress has not delegated much authority to the president, with the exception of, you know, some changes that took place during the FDR administration. And this is something they've taken very seriously and guarded for a long time. But we really are beginning to see some changes in, you know, let's call it a model of the presidency. And Trump just has a different perception of what a president is and what the president should be doing in terms of exercising authority. Though it might not explicitly break the letter of the Constitution, it certainly is challenging a lot of the assumptions we've held about the presidency since the foundation of the Republic.
Yeah. Lisa, help us understand what's in the Constitution and what is just tradition.
Right. Yeah. So we have Congress having that quote unquote, you know, power of the purse. So, you know, we have those Article I powers that are given to Congress. But over time, we've seen some changes with respect to that process. Not necessarily, like Dave was saying, so much in Congress just completely abdicating its power. Any of the changes that have been made have been things that are usually just to try to ensure that the budgetary process functions well. So, for instance, giving the president the power to set the budget. So, kind of makes sense in terms of a logistical standpoint. One person can then reach out to all of the different agencies that are the ones needing the appropriations in order to implement legislation and various federal programs. And then that goes to Congress. Congress hashes it all out. Obviously, we'll go back to the president, but it's still seen as Congress having primary control over funds. And that's how we've always talked about it. So that's why the president, the Supreme Court even, has to care about how Congress views them. They need them for the funds. You know, the Supreme Court can't implement their own decisions. The president can't just, you know, run the executive branch with no money, sort of thing. So that's kind of here where we're seeing some changes, where President Trump is very heavy-handed, and for the most part, Congress is just going along. You know, some of them are even making comments about not really knowing the specifics of what's in the legislation. It's more a vote on the referendum of Trump than it is on, you know, really how should government funds be spent.
Yeah, saying publicly, I trust the president, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt, which seems unusual to say openly, at the very least. That's one of the things that has surprised me, that instead of hearing always, I agree with the president, and I trust the president, or this is why I think this should happen. Instead, it is an open expression of loyalty over agreement sometimes. And I find that kind of compelling to listen to how that's changing in their language.
Yeah, and there's a new attitude in terms of what exactly a congressional appropriation means. Up until now, usually we've seen these appropriations as Congress has said we're going to spend this money, and we are going to spend this money. The new attitude is, while Congress may have appropriated this money, this will be a ceiling, not necessarily a floor. And if the president just doesn't want to spend it, so be it. And this is one of the kind of the underpinnings of a lot of that Project 2025 when it came to appropriation, is this new understanding of presidential authority and a lot more deference to the president when it comes to appropriations.
I remember high school civics, and one of the things that we learned was about pork and this idea that individual senators and representatives would go to Washington on behalf of a pet project at home. And sometimes you would do a case study how something got passed in Congress because somebody in Georgia wanted it, for example, but maybe it wasn't even good for the rest of the country. Have we changed our expectation that our congressional delegation should be going and trying to fight for the interests of their constituents in South Dakota to more of a, hey, we expect these people to carry out the president's agenda? That's the bar. We want them to do that versus doing something that we would say, hey, this is specifically, you know, saving Ellsworth Air Force Base comes to mind, isn't it? And is it, as an example, not that that's pork, but, you know, that was such a big deal that, you know, John Thune went to Washington and was responsible, and, of course, Tom Daschle before him, responsible for laying the groundwork to make sure that happened for a state. Is that shifting?
I'm not at all convinced it's shifting in the minds of voters.
Okay.
I think this really is an elite-driven process, primarily by the president right now and his supporters in Congress. And at the moment, most Republicans are just not willing to stick their necks out and defy the president simply because of this perceived fear they have of having an electoral cost in the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, the biggest fear right now for these folks is the idea of getting primaried, that the president could put forward a challenger in their district and they could find themselves out of a job. This has happened a few times. It is not an automatic death sentence by any measure, but it is a perceived vulnerability out there right now.
What kind of record, then, are we measuring our congressional delegates by? Are we measuring them by the president's success?
I mean, I think, like, right now, members of Congress, especially those obviously in the Republican Party or even in the Democratic Party, can very closely tie what's good or bad for their district to also their support or lack thereof of President Trump. Mm-hmm. So right now, they can very easily say what's good for the Republicans, what's good for Trump is good for, you know, in this instance, South Dakota, because we have all Republican delegates. If you're thinking about, you know, in the reverse, you could say the same thing. You know, this is bad for our district. President Trump is bad for our district. So it's very easy for them to make that tie. Even if it wasn't, you know, this isn't to say that members of Congress are constantly trying to play their constituents or anything, but they're in the game of trying to make sure that they can talk about every single thing that they do in a way that ensures that they get reelected and that it either is helping their policy agenda and their advocacy for the state or it's not.
And a big shift we've seen in terms of electoral behavior and attitudes amongst the public is nationalization of congressional elections. Over the past 25 years or so, most elections are nationalized. Most people are voting primarily on their partisanship, and the natural advantage towards incumbents really has disappeared over the years. We just don't see as many Republican-leaning districts voting for Democrats and vice versa that we saw in the 80s and the 90s, like we did here in the Dakotas, where it's a solidly Republican state, but, you know, we have this congressional delegation, mostly Democrats, that's doing well by the state, and people are willing to vote against their partisanship for individual qualities of those candidates. That just doesn't happen any longer. And this all just kind of plays into the president's favor at this moment because we've already nationalized these things. There's a lot of deference offered to this president, and it just means a much more powerful presidency in the end.
So that explains something I've been wondering about, which is why so many people care about the mayoral race in New York City. And you just answered it for me. It's been nationalized because of a passion for or a passion against a candidate that Republicans feel represents everything that they don't want to happen in the nation. And yet mm-hmm. he's finding incredible success among voters on the streets of New York.
And the mayor, who is, you know, in Trump's favor right now and has been currying favor of the president. Yeah. So absolutely.
And that just seems like it'd be hard to follow them all with.
Yeah.
How would you ever keep up? You would have to be checking the news every 5 minutes to find out every potentially nationalized individual race.
Right, but what that means, at the level of an individual voter, is you're going to be looking for cues on your particular race from the president, from national party leaders, and that's going to be the most important influence in your vote. It doesn't require people to be keeping track of all of these things all the time. It's just looking at those cue givers in your particular jurisdiction.
Influencers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, and this is why you have members of Congress, like Dave was talking about, who are concerned about being primaried. The minute President Trump puts his support behind someone else, that's a huge cue against you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned FDR. Are there other precedents? I was thinking of the Affordable Care Act and President Obama, or 9/11 and George W. Bush. Have there been other times, Lisa, especially in history, where presidents have had outsized influences because of some kind of emergency? Emergency, depending on how you define emergency.
a new idea of that. I need to update my constitutional law government powers syllabus to spend more time on emergencies past things like 9/11 and wars.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So,
well, and this is the danger of the legislation that was put in place back in the 70s to prevent exactly what's going on now. Is it created this requirement that an emergency be established. And, well, now the president can declare emergencies for all sorts of things, particularly when it comes to authorities, when it comes to trade and tariffs. And, you know, this idea that we have this crisis, this emergency of fentanyl flowing in from Canada being used as an excuse to restrict trade with Canada, it's just absurd.
So other precedents of other presidents who tried to step into a higher authority and use the presidency in ways that the Constitution may actually allow, other than FDR? Or, I mean, he might not even be the best example. I'm not a historian of FDR's time frame, but he comes to mind.
Yeah. Lots of presidents have pushed it. They're always pushing the bounds. They're always working on the margins. They're always trying to expand their authority. That's just kind of the nature of the office and the nature of the people who inhabit the office. Long gone are the days where presidents would very consciously say, well, you know, I'm going to very judiciously exercise my authority and not go beyond the letter of the Constitution. I don't even know if we ever had those days when it comes right down to it. But what's very different now is we have a court that is much more amenable to these sorts of expansions of authority and power. We have a populace that is more amenable to it, so long as they are playing on the right team. We just have a different understanding of what the president ought to do and what the president's powers ought to be than we did 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
Here's one of the concerns, and there's a lot of sports analogies coming out, talking about the front of the jersey versus the back of the jersey or what team you're on. And there can be dynasties, but times change and other teams become victorious. Is this setting up a precedent for future presidencies to leverage, whether that means the change in public perception or whether that just means the recognition that you're going to have to lead this country dramatically, you have to have somewhat of a cult of personality. Like, how does this impact not only how future presidents will use their authority, but the kinds of people who will run for office and win, knowing what it takes to use the authority?
I think this goes back to what Dave was saying, just that you have presidents who often are trying to push the boundaries in whatever way they think is possible at times in order to get different agenda items passed. That's not necessarily to say that it's quite to the extent that Trump is today, but all of that ends up serving as essentially precedent for future presidents. But with a certain sort of caution with that statement is to also say that the types of people who are interested in running for president are often the kinds of people who are more willing to sort of push the boundaries a little bit. And they have that sort of ego that makes them think, what I want to do is good, is what's best for the country, right, is what's best for the people. Or even if I know there's some people who don't, I just need to sell most of Congress and the public in order to ensure that it happens. So I think some of it is like, yes, what Trump is doing does serve as somewhat of a precedent, but it also is just in a long line of what we've been seeing with respect to the presidency.
And I have to push back on this team thing a little bit, because what that presumes is that we have strong political parties in this country, and we just do not. Traditionally, one of the most important restraints on presidents, particularly during the 19th century and early 20th century, was the political party. Back when parties had a lot more control over who was going to be nominated, who was going to be their standard bearer, those powers of the party have really eroded to a point where we don't see this weak of parties in virtually any other democracy in the world. And what that allows to have happen is for a very personalized presidency where somebody can really nurture a cult of personality. They can steamroll a lot of these party functions like nomination and really do some damage and expand the office a great deal like we're seeing now.
The president has said that in 6 months he's gotten more done than any president before him. And even though this president is prone to hyperbole, I think you could make an argument that things are moving faster in this country than maybe what we're used to. We're used to a slower back and forth. We're used to more of a gridlock in Washington. And now we're seeing things happen very, very swiftly. How does that compare, Lisa, to, you know, constitutional democracies or other forms of government across the world?
Yeah, so for us to see all of these things moving as quickly is not even really what the framers necessarily intended. So when we're talking about all of the checks and balances that were put in place to make sure that we didn't have things just changing left and right, they really wanted stability and to, of course, try to avoid tyranny of the majority. Other governmental systems also have similar checks and balances baked in to, again, try to ensure that there's not this constant upheaval that's taking place. But obviously, as we've talked, not just today, but other times when we've been speaking with you, there's a lot of different ways that you can make change happen quickly without outright necessarily violating the Constitution, or just by ensuring that you do have, you know, a court that's amenable to what you want to do, a Congress that is willing to vote in your favor. So that can facilitate things moving even quicker than what we necessarily think, or, you know, also some of these more unorthodox approaches to lawmaking where, you know, we're seeking provisions in appropriations bills and things like that.
So what do people at home want when it comes to access to their congressional delegates as well? As they go into recess and they come back, is this the same kind of system that we used to have where, you know, someone's sitting around your kitchen table and talking about what's happening in Washington or having a town hall or driving across the state? Has that also changed to, you know, telephone town halls and social media and showing up on a podcast and doing an interview there? That feels to me like it's also shifting. What are your thoughts?
There does seem to be a change to a certain extent with what we're seeing, but obviously a lot of that does have to do with technology. So a lot of even some of this change back when we started having a commuter Congress, where most members of Congress are not in Washington, D.C. when they are not in session. So they get done on Friday afternoon, they're headed home, and, you know, they'll come back Monday afternoon. So when they are in recess, we're just kind of seeing them continuing to go back to their districts. Obviously, there's exceptions depending on travel. But, you know, I think members of Congress are still very focused on being present in their districts. It's just the way in which they're present might be a little bit different. So they maybe aren't necessarily at folks' kitchen tables, but they are, you know, attending various events that are taking place in their districts or states and just making sure that folks know they're there and whatnot. There has been a decrease, it seems like, on some members of Congress doing town halls. Like, that has been a bit of a conversation just because I think there's a lot of angry folks who show up, but I still think they're finding ways to connect.
Dave, what do you think about access and what people are getting when it comes to that handshake and that kitchen table conversation?
Well, I think a lot of our expectations are just different now. You know, 30, 40 years ago, again, people were willing to vote cross party lines on a regular basis. And our whole approach is just different now. So even somebody going to a town hall or going to one of these candidate functions, they're just entering with a different set of assumptions about who that person is and what their job is. And if they are of the opposite party, we're just not going to give them the same kind of deference that we did before. And we're going to make some presumptions about, you know, everything that they do, kind of, and separate it from constituent service. Constituent service just isn't as important as it once was when it comes to elections. So the kinds of efforts that they make just don't have the same kind of payouts today that they did 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah. I would also argue that if you sit for a podcast with friendly podcast roundtable, that gives the illusion that you're having a kitchen table conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've said that about this show. It's like, you know, South Dakota's kitchen table, that we're sitting down with people and we're just talking as if we're talking around that. You can reach millions of people with a national podcast, but it's not really a kitchen table in South Dakota. All right. Any other thoughts about this and how the model of the presidency is changing for better, for worse, implications going forward? Certainly we'll be studying this in history for a long period of time. Like Lisa was saying, updating the syllabus to, you know, what is an emergency and who gets to decide or an invasion? What is an invasion? These definitions. Any other thoughts?
Oh, I mean, I think like one thing that is somewhat interesting in terms of the first Trump presidency is we did see things seem to go back to normal, and we'll put that in air quotes, with the presidency during Biden. So it wasn't as if Trump set up this playbook that then everybody's just abiding by. But I do think moving forward, it's going to be interesting to see what happens depending on what the next race looks like. Because going back to weak parties, I don't feel like the parties are very good lately at cultivating who their candidates are going to be. So depending on the personalities and who wins, you know, if we get a President J.D. Vance, I think we're just going to see an extension of some of what we're seeing with Trump versus if we get a President Rubio or something.
Sure.
And I don't know what the Democrats are coming up with necessarily on their end, but just kind of thinking about possible Trump administration folks.
Yeah, I think part of the reason we didn't see as many durable shifts from the first Trump administration was, in some respects, it kind of caught everybody by surprise, including Trump. They were not as thoughtful the first time around as they have been this time around. And, I mean, this whole Project 2025 thing, you know, when we first heard about it, you know, people were kind of suspicious of, you know, what they were up to, or is this, you know, it kind of had this conspiratorial air to it, so people weren't taking it seriously in that regard. But these guys hit the ground this time with a comprehensive plan as to how they can go about maximizing the power of the presidency in just about every facet of policy, whether we're talking budgets, whether we're talking foreign policy, trade policy, and now probably the scariest thing is monetary policy, and how they just have this concerted effort not only to just, you know, publicly undermine Jerome Powell and the board, who's meeting now right now, or meeting, you know, at this moment, deciding the next round of interest rates, but also on a legal basis, you know, challenging the very legality of the Federal Reserve, you know, just undercutting it in every way possible. And we're seeing that in policy area after policy area after policy area. They really had their ducks in a row this time. And if these things stick, And if future presidents are willing to follow it, this could be a very consequential presidency.